Do we have policies? Do we have guardrails? Do we have standards?
But here's the problem. We can't even agree. We can't even agree what disinformation is. You can't even agree that it was disinformation, that the Russians fed information to the Steele dossier. If you can't agree to that, how are we ever going to come to an agreement on what is disinformation so you can police it on social media? I think you've got no idea what disinformation is, and I don't think the government's capable of it. Do you know who the greatest propagator of disinformation in the history of the world is? The U.S. government. Are you familiar with McNamara, the Pentagon Papers? Are you familiar with George W. Bush and the weapons of mass destruction? Are you familiar with Iran-Contra? I mean, think of all the debates and disputes we've had over the last 50 years in our country. We work them out by debating them. We don't work them out by the government being the arbiter. I don't want guardrails. I want you to have nothing to do with speech. You think we can't determine, you know, speech by traffickers is disinformation? You think the American people are so stupid they need you to tell them what the truth is? You can't even admit what the truth is with the Steele dossier. I don't trust government to figure out what the truth is. Government is largely disseminating disinformation.
Welcome to the Libertarian Institute, Odyssey, and YouTube channel. I'm joined by Tommy Salmons. Tommy, what's happening?
What's up, man? How are y'all doing?
I am doing very well. Tommy's show is Year Zero. Find it on the right-hand portion in the podcast section on our website, and our news editor, Kyle Anzalone. Kyle, how's it going?
Great to be here with you boys tonight.
First story, Tommy. You went on the Pete Quinona Show, episode 735, The Globalist War on Local Politics. Fill us in on what you gentlemen discussed here.
Oh, it's dystopian. I run into an essay by Parag Khanna, who you and I were talking about earlier, Keith. And the essay is called Dismantling Empire Through Devolution, where he's talking about basically with the decentralization movements around the world, like Brexit or Trump or whatever, that he's saying, let the people have their culture, let them have their culture locally, let them have their local cultures and move forward and be comfortable in their locations. And we'll just pump money into the politics and into the businesses, and we'll take control of the supply chains and of the businesses. Now, if you've ever listened to or read any Parag Khanna, one of the things he says is that the supply chain is the new arms race in the 21st century, and that through connectography, and what he means by that is you no longer adhere to borders. You no longer have a military that is there to secure your borders, but the military is there to secure your supply chains and your income streams. And so he looks at the world as a skeleton and the infrastructure as the bones to that skeleton, and the communications networks as the neurosystem, the nervous system. So we started off with that, and then we started diving into where how this money is being pumped into locations and what this money is being utilized for. So we discovered that Mark Zuckerberg dumped over $350 million into local races in 2020. There's a corporation called Arabella Advisors who used five different 501c3s to launder $1.2 billion into local races. You have a guy, a Swiss billionaire named Hans-Jörg Wiese, who was pumping in $49 million. $410 million. There was another guy, Pierre, I can't remember his last name. I think he works with Microsoft, who pumped in $45 million. You had George Soros funding the attorney generals and prosecutors' runs in many major cities. So you have this attack on the community level. So as libertarians like to think about things as being very community oriented and decentralizing it down to the smallest location, these people are pumping money into these communities in order to control these local races and to take the say away from the decentralized movement, to hijack the decentralized movement and moving into a more global direction.
Excellent topics there. Yeah, local politics. You've really learned the importance of that with police enforcing some roles and not others. And the level of tyranny is heavily decided. Michael Malice once joked saying that without local police enforcement, politicians' laws are just letters to Santa Claus. And therein lies the importance of a community. Are they going to call the cops on me for building this, extension on my porch or not? If I don't get the license,
One of the things I recall, and we'll probably touch on this on one of my next articles as well, is that in like 2013, 2014, there was a bill passed by the Obama administration to where the federal government claimed that they had all rights of all water, no matter whose property it was on and no matter how big it was. So it could just be like a puddle on your property and they were claiming the water rights. And so I'm wondering, and as I said, we're going to talk about food shortages here in a little bit, but I'm wondering with these food shortages, if you're not going to see something very similar.
Next story, we have Kyle Anzalone. Oh, God, I was devastated to see this one. Kyle, what's your first story for us?
Yeah, so on Wednesday, pretty, I think, early in Israel, Israeli forces killed Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was a journalist for Al Jazeera in Israel for 25 years, so she's a very recognized face, and she was covering a Israeli raid on the refugee camp in Jenin, an Palestinian town in the West Bank, and she was there with four other journalists, including Ali Samodi, who was actually wounded and shot in the back, although he was wearing a bulletproof vest. And so today she was wearing a vest very similar to one she's pictured here in. It's the internationally recognized blue vest with press written in all caps across it. And She was shot in the head. It's reported by Palestinian sources by Israeli fire. Now, initially, the Israeli government denied this, with the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett issuing a statement on Twitter saying that this was the result of Palestinian indiscriminate gunfire, which kind of seems odd if you have indiscriminate fire and one round finds its way in between a bulletproof vest and a bulletproof helmet, which, you know, seems more likely a sniper fire. So, you had this occur, and then the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has a map where they were able to geosource not only where Shireen was on the ground, but also where the video that Bennett posted took place. And it's very clear there's no possible way that the fire from this video could have hit Shireen. I think a few hundred yards away, and there were no sight lines. It had to travel through several buildings. So it was just, absurd that was the fire. And then Barak Ravid, who reports on Israel for Axios, reported that an IDF commander had somewhat walked that back, and now they were saying they weren't sure, what bullet actually killed Shireen or not. But it does very much appear that every eyewitness says that only Israeli forces were in the area. All the journalists, report that. And then you can actually see on the video that whoever killed Shireen continued to fire on the journalists. And you actually see like a Palestinian man in a white shirt come and try to pull Shireen's body away, and was actually shot at a couple of times and has to retreat to cover. And the journalist, there's one other female journalist who was with Shireen, and then, is kind of pinned down there. And she's also taking some fire before he's able to help her get away. And so, absolutely terrible what happened. Of course, the reason this is a big deal is because the U.S. funds Israel with $4 billion a year. And while my guess is what's going to happen here, Keith, is it's going to take about a week. The U.S. is going to say, Well, after an investigation, it turns out that what killed her was the Israeli bullet going through her face. And then they're going to issue a general condemnation of violence against journalists. It's not going to be the Israeli government's violence against journalists. It's going to be, we're opposed to violence. We're opposed to violence against journalists, but not, you know, we're condemning and taking action against Israel for killing, you know, this journalist in the West Bank. Again, a well-known journalist who I think almost you could maybe compare to, like, and I don't want to say this to insult her legacy, but just maybe in a way Americans could understand, like a Richard Engel or something like that, where, you know, somebody who's on the news every night reporting from somewhere, right? She's a household name in Palestinian homes, but probably even more so because she's reported on, you know, wars against the Palestinian people and the occupation of Israel of the Palestinians. So I think, you know, she probably has a little bit of a hero status as well. So my guess is that this is going to be really a major boiling point in Israel. Recently, or since the start of the year, I guess there's been about 34 Palestinians killed, including 10 under the age of 18, mostly 14 to 18 year old teenagers, but also some younger kids than that, by either Israeli forces, Israeli settlers, or Israeli citizens. And then you've also had 18 Israelis killed by Palestinians. And so this is, you know, pretty serious level of violence that we have going on. This, and then after the, you know, Shireen was killed, Palestinians began to gather at her house in Jerusalem and police show up. There's a report that the police demanded that the Palestinian flag be taken down. I don't speak Arabic, so I can't confirm what the police were doing there, but they were at her home, you know, which is adding greatly to, you know, everybody's discussed with this, and I'm sure a lot of the tensions in Palestine. So, you know, I think there's a couple ways to look at this. The one is just what's going to happen next in Israel, because I think there's, I don't want to say like going to be retaliation, but I think the Palestinians are going to at the very least continue to protest, and Palestinian protests are typically met with violence from the Israeli government. And so either that got exacerbated, or we could see like Islamic Jihad or Hamas in the Gaza Strip firing some rockets in protest of this, because they've carried out those kind of actions in the past. And then, you know, potentially a major Israeli bombing campaign against the Gaza Strip coming. I'm very worried about this is the direction that we're headed again, just like last year. Now, the other thing, of course, this is a perfect opportunity for people in the U.S. to put some pressure on our government to, you know, not just make meaningless statements, but to actually start to strip away some of the aid that we give Israel. You know, it's just as disgusting as the aid we give, say, Egypt or Saudi Arabia or the UAE. It absolutely needs to end. Representative Rashida Tlaib was, you know, pointing this out on the House floor. And so, you know, she is a marginal voice, but the fact that she's bringing it up is important. However, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi is just offering the, well, we need to investigate and violence against journalists is bad, which is absolutely meaningless. And, you know, again, the U.S. is going to issue a condemnation, then slide Tel Aviv a $4 billion check and say, ah, don't do it again, guys. But, you know, not really do anything about it.
Yeah, it was so cheap watching Trevor Noah sort of like after his half jokes are finished and he doesn't really take any shots. He says, well, it's great that I could stand here and mock the president. You can't do this in North Korea, Russia, China, or Saudi Arabia, which is an important point. However,
he didn't say Israel.
Yeah, really. He should have. But this is the perfect example. We're giving you an opportunity to really show us that you guys care about freedom of the press, because we're called conspiracy theorists when we say that they don't really care about it at all. And if they could silence us, they absolutely would. So here's your opportunity. Please show us and just treat these people like you treat anyone else in the international court. I'm always hearing that Putin is terrible and his enemies are constantly going missing. And I mean, they fake election interference on behalf of Putin. This is actually a real case where you can actually prosecute someone. So yes, excellent job getting this story up as fast as you did. My first story is from a book review that I did of Douglas Murray. The book is titled The War on the West. I really like the book overall. It's broken up into four sections, one on race, history, culture, and religion. I really like the portion where this is towards the end. He said, the problem Western civilization faces is resentment, and the solution is gratitude. I quoted from the section. He says, a great building such as a church or a cathedral can take decades or even centuries to build, but it can be burned to the ground or otherwise brought down in an afternoon. And I thought his section on gratitude was probably the most important point of the entire book. It's about, I think, 400 pages or so. I read the Kindle version. But as good as it is, I think there's one thing that Murray could certainly improve on. And that is his heroism of Winston Churchill. So here's my general response to seeing Churchill as one of what he calls the greatest Englishmen in the history of Britain. My case is as follows. Winston Churchill is a hero of many to people of goodwill. However, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Murray on the issue. As First Lord of the Admiralty on August 12, 1914, Churchill initiated a blockade around Germany, starving hundreds of thousands of civilians to death. If this isn't wrong, nothing is. He caused the Narvik debacle of 1940, which led Chamberlain to step down and Churchill to be appointed, later losing his 1945 election. So this alone, we have the great hero of democracy never being elected to prime minister. He initiated bombing of civilians with physicist Frederick Lindemann's dehousing plan as his inspiration. He enforced the National Service Act of 1939, which enslaved men ages 18 to 41 to fight in a war, the most horrific working conditions imaginable. He disapproved of Chamberlain giving the Sudetenland to Hitler, then surrendered the Sudetenland and half of Europe to Joseph Stalin in Yalta in 1945. Churchill later wrote in his memoirs, this is page 14 in the introduction to The Gathering Storm, written March 1948. The human tragedy reaches its climax in the fact that after all the exertions and sacrifices of hundreds of millions of people, and the victories of the righteous cause, we still have not found peace or security, and that we lie in the grip of even worse perils than those we have surmounted. So overall, I thought the book was terrific, and I highly recommend it. I think Douglas Murray is wrong on Churchill, along with basically his foreign policy ideology. He has this total double standard for the governments, especially governments of the West. Tommy Salmons, our next story here is why socialists should become teachers. What website is this from?
That's from the Democratic Socialist of America. So, it's there's a summary here in the introduction, kind of gives you what the whole thing is about. But what they're doing is they're saying that the teachers union is the strongest union of all the unions within the United States. And so by being part of the strongest union of the United States, that you have more sway and more pull economically and politically. Mm. And they feel like that teachers are so put upon a throne that it is easier to be socially accepted as a teacher to pronounce these socialist ideas. But they even say in the article, in their introduction, not to come out openly with socialist propaganda and to talk to these people where they are in such a way that moves them in the direction of socialism, but doesn't actually promote socialism. So I'm going to read here from the introduction a little bit. It says, it's talking about the West Virginia strike. And it says the West Virginia strike didn't happen by chance. It was the result of creative shop floor organizing by teachers with socialist politics. These teachers introduced a fundamentally different vision of their state than what was on offer from either elected officials or union leaders. And they were able to do this because they had organic connections to their coworkers. Rather than shouting socialist messaging at workers from afar, these teachers were able to alter the direction of the movement from within. Then it goes on to say, this pamphlet argues that socialists should take jobs as teachers and other school-based workers for the political, economic, and social potential the industry holds. The essay goes on to explain what a teacher's job is, how to become a teacher, if you're not interested in becoming a teacher, how to get into the school board or into an administrative position within the teachers union, etc. So this is as many people have guessed and, you know, quandered over for the last many years. This is the admittance that they want to get into these positions to where they can hold influence as socialist leaders and do so subversively.
Yeah, I noticed that one of the states they mentioned at the beginning was Arizona. Now, the Red for Ed movement in Arizona had like all support from all the parents who want to be trendy. And they're like, oh, yay, the teachers are going on strike. And oh, they should be paid, you know, 50 times more and everything. And I go, well, the kids spend 12 years there and they're so dumb that it's widely recognized that, oh, they have to go to college. You're not going to go. Well, you have to go to college. You basically got no education the last 12 years. So you're useless unless you take 4 more years. And now this is an admission that they're doing a terrible job. But second, it was like after the 4th or 5th day where the parents turned on the teachers in Arizona, where it was like, you know, people were saying, oh, it's bring your kid to work day because, you know, the teachers are on strike. Oh, this is going to be fun and trendy. But then once the governor started negotiating with them, all the parents that were certainly vocal at the beginning were either silent or switched sides. Because, I mean, it was like Red for Ed. There were all these marches and everything. I go, you have to be, you know, you have to have some self-awareness that you're saying we get the kids for 12 years. Also, after decades of this, the guy who wins the election is basically Hitler, Donald Trump. That like any time you attack who the people vote for, you're just attacking the result of what you guys have been teaching kids for decades upon decades. So they provide the worst service. And so if they were volunteers, they would be overpaid. I cannot stand the teachers.
I remember when I was a kid, my mom would sometimes have to work Saturdays and my dad was working 3 jobs. So like I wasn't able to stay at home with him. So I had to go to work with her. And I remember sitting under her desk at work in that little cubicle, sitting under that desk, playing with toys, trying to keep myself occupied, being bored out of my mind. And so take your child to work day is not fun for anybody. It's not fun for the kid. It's not fun for the adults. It's not fun for anybody. But you know what this made me think of? I started thinking about here recently, we've seen these stories about Starbucks starting to unionize. And I'm like, I wonder where these kids got this idea from.
Yeah, really. And I'm all for unions and people, you know, using their power. But my thing, I was thinking, I go, okay, let me think of my initial entry-level jobs. Would I rather management be making the decisions or my coworkers making the decisions? And I go, yeah. Oh, hell. I worked at Walmart, dude.
I worked at McDonald's. Yeah, exactly. I don't want a bunch of 17-year-olds at McDonald's trying to figure out how to manage the place.
Oh, no. And then I worked at a call center for Dish Network, which I loved, but that they did not attract the kind of workers that you would want voting to influence you. I worked at a restaurant. Under no situation should the entry-level people in that example have more power. Or maybe they should just do it voluntarily and stop the indoctrination, for heaven's sakes.
I mean, Keith, it's a hostile working environment. Those poor people have Hollywood lunatics gluing themselves to counters over surcharges on vegan milk. So if they need to unionize to get a little bit better security, I understand.
Never mind. I've been wrong about everything. Vegan milk. That's where the argument lies. Kyle Anzalone, next article.
Yeah, this one is from yesterday. There's a new report out on the amount of spying that Immigration Services is doing on Americans. They've spent $2.8 billion between 2008 and 2021. Now, of course, all these different agencies are able to share their spying and surveillance capabilities too. So it's important to remember that just because they only spent $2.8 billion doesn't mean they didn't access other databases and some and stuff like that. And that's one of the things highlighted in this report that details how one in three Americans now have their, you, when you go to the DMV, they ask you, and I think they really pressure you now. I feel like the last time I had, say no a few times, if you want your photo uploaded into the, you know, database. And I think the lady was like, oh, it'll be, you know, if something ever happens, it could help identify you. At that point, I don't care, lady. You know, I'm worried about what happens to me while I'm alive. So anyways, yeah, they're really pushing people to do this. Now, what the Immigration Services is able to do, if they think they have a photo of a, you know, somebody they think is in the U.S. without the proper paperwork or whatever, they could run that photo through that database, get name, address, and everything like that. Now, there are 17 states that allow illegal immigrants to obtain driver's license, and five of those states also allow the Immigration Services to run the photos through the database. And that's almost worse than just not allowing people to get driver's licenses. I mean, how underhanded is that? You're basically setting these people up to get deported. And so that's pretty disgusting. Although I'm sure the federal government is able to like leverage different highway funds or something like that, if you, you know, allow the federal databases to add to this. But more disturbing, I think in the case of like 70%, almost three quarters of Americans, the Immigration Services could basically has access to databases that allow, you know, you switch your cable bill, your electric bill, anything like that. They could figure out exactly where people live to nail them down. And then there was one other thing that I found extremely troublesome in the report, and that is Immigration Services, if an undocumented or an unaccompanied minor coming to the United States is seeking asylum, one of the things they're doing is questioning those minors without any kind of representation, pushing for names of relatives in the United States of undocumented, you know, immigrants, so they could deport them. And, you know, it seems wrong to be able to question a minor without any kind of representation in any situation, just, you know, because somebody's coming here without being an American citizen doesn't necessarily mean they have no rights whatsoever. And, you know, and these ICE guys are pretty nasty with some of their tactics and stuff like that. So I can imagine, you know, them really bullying some kids. And like, how are you going to handle that if you're 13 years old and the ICE guy tricks you into giving up mommy, and then your mom gets deported? You're, you know, these are the things that are going on. It's pretty messed up.
Unbelievable. My next one here is from Peter Van Buren. This is a gentleman who was formerly working for the State Department. Here he is. I got him next to the picture of Iraqi shock and awe. I thought that would be fitting. I titled it Politics and Deception in Wartime. Foreign Service Officer, retired Peter Van Buren, and myself. This is a video and podcast. We talk about a number of important things, one of which is why on earth are veterans committing suicide at a rate of something like 22 a day. I thought he had a great answer for that. Got to watch that to check it out. Now, one of the quotes that I really liked that Van Buren seemed to enjoy was from Rothbard's Egalitarianism as Revolt Against Nature, where Rothbard says the libertarian's basic attitude toward war must be, it is legitimate to use violence against criminals in defense of one's rights of person and property. It is completely impermissible to violate the rights of other innocent people. War, then, is only proper when the exercise of violence is rigorously limited to the individual criminals. And this is important because when we come across as anti-war, to some people, it might literally seem like we're just saying, look, when bad people do bad things, just lay down and take it. And, you know, maybe we'll convince them. Maybe we could write letters to human traffickers and ask them to reconsider their ways and abide by the non-aggression principle. But this Rothbard quote perfectly encapsulates the reason that you should have the libertarian position on things like war. So Mr. Van Buren and I went through Russiagate 1.0, Hillary Clinton on the debate stage saying 17 intelligence agencies confirmed Russian interference. 4 years later, Russiagate 2.0, Biden's on the debate stage saying we have 50 intelligence officers, four former heads of the CIA from both parties saying that what he's talking about, this laptop, is a Russian plant. And then Trump laughs it off. So I had a really good time talking to him. He was a gentleman throughout, and he was in Iraq for a year. And I read him George Bush's case for going into Iraq in a book that Bush published, well, allegedly wrote in 2010, titled Decision Points. So I thought it was important to steel man Bush's position and get Mr. Van Buren to respond. Overall, I had a excellent time with him. Next story, Tommy Salmons, what do you have for us?
Well, we got food shortages, as I mentioned earlier, that are coming down the pike with the war in Russia, war in Ukraine with Russia. There's a lot of fertilizer and food that is not being exported out of that region into our country. And we see it right now with baby formula. You might go to the, I know I go to the store sometimes, and I'll go to the cold meat section. And 1 week there will be no bacon, but there will be plenty of ham and bologna. And then the next week there will be no bologna or ham, and there will be plenty of turkey, chicken, and bacon. So it's been like this going on for 2 years since the lockdowns. It's something that we're having to constantly deal with as a result of the lockdowns. And in the story, there's a couple of things I wanted to read that I found very interesting. I think it was in the second part, first chapter, where it says, looking across the consumer retail landscape, the report identified groceries, which accounts for 13% of consumer spending, as the category most heavily impacted by reported product shortages, with 51% of consumers reporting product shortages. As you read through the article, you come through another section where it says, in March 2022, the Consumer Price Index, which measures how much consumers pay for goods, was up 8.5% for all items and up 10% for at-home food purchases compared to 1 year ago. So one of the things I talk about on my show a lot is that I grow food and the necessity for being self-sufficient. This doesn't only go for food. You're going to have to figure out alternative fuel methods too, and getting yourself around. And I want to touch on that here in just a second, but there are things you can do locally at home. If you can't grow food, you can easily make compost. If you need to know how to make compost, you can reach out to me at TommySalmons@gmail.com. There's about a 20-minute video. It walks you through everything, how to make compost out of grass clippings and cardboard or pine shavings or dead leaves. So all you need is something green, like weeds or grass, something brown, like cardboard, grass, dead leaves or pine shavings, some water and oxygen. And it takes about 2 or 3 months and you'll have compost. So if you can't grow your own food, it would really behoove the average person to learn how to make compost, strike up a relationship with a local farmer. And I know some people live in cities and don't have farms close to them, but you'll have a farmer's market close to you and meet some local farmers in which you can exchange compost for food. And you can do this. I mean, they're going to be short on fertilizer. They're not going to be able to grow everything. They're not going to be able to fertilize everything. So they'll have the necessity to work with you in this area. Also, start growing, you know, on your balcony, like a little balcony garden. If you live in an apartment or if you have a little small backyard, just grow a few things. Grow some cucumbers and tomatoes. They grow really well down here where I'm at. You know, do some research on the internet, find out what grows easily in your region, and you can, you know, just start working on one or two different types of plants and only deal with those for a while until you get used to doing it. But that's the best way to learn how to do it, kind of ensure that you have a little bit of food coming in. But another thing that's going on is fuel. We're going to see that diesel is, and as a truck driver, this like strikes really close to home for me. You're going to see a situation where diesel is getting so expensive, you're going to have less truck drivers. Less truck drivers means you have less supplies. It means you have less resources available to you because you don't have anybody bringing you the resources. Unfortunately, Hamburger Helper does not grow on the grocery shelf. Somebody actually brings that to you. And as this occurs, I've witnessed a couple of times that I'm talking to people that own small gas stations and they're in tears because they're closing down. They're losing business because the gas prices are getting so high. Diesel prices are getting so high. They've been running a truck stop for 10 years. And no trucks are coming through purchasing the diesel because their diesel is at $5.25 a gallon. And they can go down to like Flying J 10 miles down the road and buy it for $5.19 a gallon. So they're these smaller gas stations, these smaller mom and pop shops are at threat to lose their business and closing down because of the inflation around energy specifically. I walked in a place the other day. It's a place I stop at every once in a while to get a snack. And she had spread gum across the front of the counter to make it look like the shelves were full. Just individual packages of gum. Because she didn't have enough snacks to fill up her shelves. So she had to spread everything way out. She's not getting full. Like when you go into a store, you'll see king size Hershey's bars and king size Reese's. She had individual Reese's cups that she had bought at the dollar store across the street and broke open and was spreading them out on the shelves to make it look like the shelves were full. She doesn't have 20 ounce Cokes because she can't afford to have Coca-Cola delivered to her. So she is shopping at the dollar store across the street and buying 16.9 ounce Coke bottles and selling them in place of the 20 ounce. So you're going to start seeing this type of impact on your small businesses when because they're not going to be able to afford to stay in business due to the inflation and due to the prices of energy and especially fuel and diesel that are going around. So just keep that in mind whenever you're operating, especially in a small town, and understand where what the plight these people are facing and just how difficult it is for everybody right now.
Vitally important stuff there, man. Thank you for sharing. Kyle, next issue on Iran.
This is an important story that I've been covering for a while, but we have a major development in that, and that's the relationship between Iran and Venezuela. Under the Trump administration, he allowed John Bolton to draw up maximum pressure economic warfare campaigns against both Caracas and Tehran. Of course, in Iran, it was after withdrawing from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal that ensured Iran wouldn't make nuclear weapons, which they didn't really want to, but it was a way to, you know, help to keep peace in not having provocations between the U.S., Israel, and Iran in the Middle East. So Trump threw that out. And then in 2019, the U.S. backed a coup attempt in Venezuela, recognizing this guy Juan Guaido as the president. He was like a regional representative to government. He only had like a national approval rating of 3%. Nobody even knew who this guy was, but the U.S. claimed he was president. In fact, when he Guaido initially proclaimed himself to be president, some of the other opposition members walked off the stage in disgust of him making this move. And so with both of these countries economically isolated from the world, essentially, minus a few other countries like China and things like that, they've increased inter-country trade. One of the things that Iran has been shipping to Venezuela for some time has been called consolidate concentrate. And what it does is it dilutes the heavy crude oil that are in the Venezuelan reserves and actually allows that the country to suck oil from the ground. And then Iran has also helped Venezuela with some infrastructure repairs. But now they are sending Venezuela crude oil. Venezuela is helping out with the shipping here. And, you know, this has increased ties between the two countries. In mid-April, Iran shipped Venezuela 200,000 barrels. Now we're at 400,000. And one of the important developments here is the U.S., especially with the Biden administration coming in, had a chance to roll back the policy, roll back the economic warfare against both Iran and Venezuela to the policy of Barack Obama, which was far better and less aggressive. He's failed to do either. You know, they've been negotiating with Iran for months. The Biden administration initially missed their opportunity to negotiate with the more moderate Rouhani government, who was the leader of Iran when Biden took office, but he failed to negotiate and it helped empower the hardliners in Iran. And so now the leader of Iran, not the Ayatollah, but the other leader is a man named Raisi, who's taking a far more hardline position, demanding the U.S. remove the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, from the international terrorism list. And the Biden administration is refusing to do this. And so now we have an impasse on those talks and nothing's happened for several months. On Venezuela, the Biden administration did nothing forever. And then, let's see, it was probably a month and a half ago, they were like, oh boy, this whole thing is becoming a real issue with Russia. We need to get some other oil. And so they reached out to Venezuela and held some talks with Maduro. Maduro even released two American citizens that were held prisoner. However, it appears those talks are now at an impasse with this week Secretary of State Antony Blinken holding a call with Juan Guaido, who's, you know, for the past 3 years been running around Venezuela, still has no power whatsoever, but is backed by the Americans, getting $1 million a year from the Americans. And every now and then he'll try to rally a major protest and overthrow Maduro, and it never works out. And so this week, Blinken reaffirmed that it was the U.S. policy to continue to back Juan Guaido's claim to power in Venezuela, and backing the coup government attempt against Maduro suggests that the U.S. isn't pursuing diplomacy there anymore.
Wow. Are you seeing this where it says the U.S. is blaming Iran for a 1996 bombing in Saudi Arabia that killed 19 U.S. airmen?
Yeah, that's, I believe, the Khobar Towers attack, if I have that right. I may have confused with something else, but the U.S. blames Iran, but I'm pretty sure it was Osama bin Laden. Gareth Porter has done some good work on this, but I would have to read Gareth's article before I could recite that in any more detail than I just did.
I was going to say, it's one of those I think I would have heard Lindsey Graham mention once or twice if they had really solid evidence on that one. My final story, how to effectively fight global poverty. Brian Kaplan and myself, he joined me to discuss his new book, Labor Econ Versus the World, makes a very compelling case for how people in poverty can move out of it by increasing competition, increasing worker productivity, as well being two vitally important features, along with a sound currency and many other things that you're much more likely to get from a free market rather than anything controlled by a coercively funded monopoly. One of my favorite quotes of Kaplan's is, "Free markets are awesome because they give businesses incentives to do good stuff. That sounds bad. Governments are awful because they give politicians incentive to do bad stuff. That sounds good. Since the correlation between what is good and what sounds good is quite low, this is a huge deal." So many gems like that from Brian Kaplan's book. And he came out with another one titled How Evil Are Politicians? Spoiler alert, very. He makes that case very, very persuasively. Each chapter is like 2 pages long, so it's a very encouraging read. But just this concept of the importance of incentives harmonizing both individual interest and group interest, I thought was so vitally important. That's why I had Dr. Kaplan on to discuss his research. Those are our 9 stories for this week's news roundup. Tommy Salmons, Kyle Anselone, thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for having me, Keith.